realizing now I don't know why I brought this up here. It's very impractical. One of these days, I'm just going to, like, open a vein and streamline coffee. First of all, before I get started, I just wanted to thank Natalie and Kathy for being able to be with us tonight. We were supposed to have you last semester, but unfortunately, due to unforeseeable events, you weren't able to come. But I'm so glad, as we all are, to have you here tonight to share your work with us and start off this season just on a really high note. So thank you. So, as we are wont to do when encountering another's work, our first instinct usually is to anchor the work's content in our own experience. To borrow A.C. Bradley's example from Poetry for Poetry's Sake, the reader often becomes like a sightseer who promenades a picture gallery, remarking on the similarity of this subject to someone they know or that landscape to the place where they grew up. It's not always easy to pass from our own minds into the mind of a poet. And if you've been lucky enough to encounter Kathy's work, you quickly realize that any effort to do so requires much more heavy lifting on your part than just sauntering through the pages of her collections and finding those common experiential denominators. There is as much to be said about how we are made to progress through the pages as there is to be said of the poems in and of themselves. Their contours, the renderings of their subjects, and the undeniable sonic textures of their language. In an interview with Connotation Press, Kathy describes herself as being, quote, a gatherer, a non-linear thinker, adding that poetry is, quote, traditionally very capacious, open to juxtaposition, opposition, and elliptical thoughts. This is observable in not only the emotional stances that her poems take towards the ambiguous reference of abstraction, but also in how they negotiate images and phonology in service to those stances. Picking up one of Kathy's collections is like walking into a room composed entirely of infinity mirrors. Everywhere you look, you're offered a different angle, a different perspective. It's an immersive and multivariate exploration of consciousness and self-orientation, but a self-orientation that goes beyond just recognition. What the work offers is the reflection of a self, but a self mise en abyss, placed into the abyss of language with all its polysemic possibility. As far as the poems themselves go, reading and rereading them is quite similar to getting onto one of those bucket swing carousels at a state fair. The first time you might choose one of the outer swings so you can feel the full tilt and whirl of her euphonic lines, become dizzy with their centripetal force, and disembark still reeling. The next time around, you might opt for a chair at the center so you can marvel at the dexterity of her wordplay, her use of vernacular and form. Regardless, each time it's a hell of a ride. And I realize that I've now used two carnivalesque models in describing the effect that reading Kathy's poems have had on me. And maybe that's because it's a kind of unimpeachable wonder that I feel when I'm reading them. I'm not worried that the chain will break, that the boom will come off his axis. Instead, I get to revel in their movement and their emotion because I know how much fine-tuning has gone into their construction. Because I know the work will hold. Kathy Fagan's fifth collection of poems is called Sycamore, published in 2017 by Milkweed Editions. Her first collection, The Raft, won the National Poetry Series. Her second, Moving in St. Rage, won the Vassar Miller Poetry Prize. Her work has appeared in the Paris Review, the Kenyon Review, Slate, Field, Narrative, The New Republic, The Nation, and Poetry, among others, and is widely anthologized. Fagan was named Ohio Poet of the Year for 2017 and is the recipient of awards and fellowships from the Ingram Merrill Foundation, the National Endowments for the Arts, and the Frost Palace, among others. The Frost Place, among others. She is the director of creative writing and the MFA program at The Ohio State University, where she is currently a professor of English, poetry editor of OSU Press, and advisor to the journal. Please join me in welcoming Kathy Fagan to the stage.
Wow, that was an amazing introduction. Is it Mari?
Yes.
I'd like to take you with me everywhere. and introduce me everywhere to everyone. So much gratitude to you and to Aaron and Keith for having us here. I'm honored to read with Natalie to a room full of some of my favorite poets. I'll read first from Sycamore, which is about 10 months old now. This book is primarily about one brutal winter and a very hard loss. Using the sycamore tree as a figure on which to focus attention helped me to cope with my grief, and writing the poems gave me a vocabulary for it. So how things get named and how strange human language is one obsession here, and I think you'll hear that in this first poem, which opens the book, and it's called Caro Nome, which is Italian for dearest name, precious name. Caro Nome. Jets shake the air, and snow breaks off a tree branch in little puffs. One cardinal. Cars moving slowly downhill on the ice. It is always someone's last day. Dearest bird, she read from the card she'd found unattached to the flowers. Happy day to our sweetest heart, love, monster, and beef dad. Their secret language. Manischewitz, she calls me, for the sweetness. Manitoba, for the expanse. Deer rest in snow, charcoal muzzle to charcoal hoof, heads slung over their shoulders like swans. One is in REM. Look at it dreaming, she said. Fern buttons unwheel in a dark place behind the snow, a contrast she loves in me. The sledding hill is closed, the days like an unused billboard, but sunsets have been fantastic, jewel-toned as the flowers unattached to the card, or hot like the cardinal who pins the whole picture up with your eye. Meanwhile, her tree is an iron room with the moon inside. Its branches have a mental disorder, so sunsets keep dodging them. I am the color of that tree she loves, and nearly as still. And my blood, which is not in this picture, will soon cool. Sunset winking out in my eyes, and her eyes welling in a language that once fell and rose in drifts, then melted, starry, she said, starry, into my warm coat. The only traditionally formal poem in the book is a pantoum, the ancient Malayan repeating verse form, that I've been practicing across several books. They've got titles like Gloom and Doom Pantoum, and Go to Your Room Pantoum. A friend dared me to write Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon Pantoum. Still working on that. This one is Kaboom Pantoum. I'll ring the bells, Ohio, tomorrow, when stars come due like lice to a grackle. Ohio, tomorrow is winter, and every winter, like lice on a grackle, we must drive defensively. This winter and every winter, I wait too long to wear a coat. We must dress defensively, but last minute still counts. If I wait to wear a coat, will you wait with me? Last minute still count. Maybe more than last words. Will you wait with me? Take Sequoia, for example. Maybe more than last words, word games reveal a lot. Sequoia, for example, is the shortest word to use each vowel once. Word games reveal a lot. Short word, tall tree, A-E-I-O-U. The tallest tree to use each vowel once does not thrive in Ohio. Short word, I, double O, no U, A-E, bell, in the mouth at either end. Um, my husband and I have been traveling a lot during this month's snowpocalypse in Ohio and the Northeast. I was reminded of this poem while we sat on the tarmac in Columbus yesterday. It's called The Signal Master's Song. I read Exunt aloud from the reality play, and it heard me. I carried its bags out. I packed its car. It could have shipped to Europe that way and never shifted its contents. A grove of sycamores stood by like willies. I invited the Arctic in. I asked the snow with its rose horizon to lie down beside me and let me weep in its arms. I was like Paris, all piano. I was the bulb that wouldn't force. I consulted maps, drew my own, asked for directions, took copious notes. I lowered my gaze in the manner of the Virgin, Cimabue, Leonardo, mild-mannered, barely smiling. I had the feeling it took a long time to get here, and always had. I believed the world was done with metaphor, and then the leaves came into bud. I mistook sunrise for sunset, and I corrected my mistake. I made many more mistakes, and corrected almost all of them, except for the ones that would become the best stories. I thought my heart would break into pieces until I heard my neighbor's cat. He said, stationary ocean, baby everything, marshy hope. He favored adjective-noun combinations no matter how strongly I objected. I invited summer in with its freak hailstones the size and color of human teeth. We ate ox together. It lingered like an odor of sugar in the cabin. I had, in short, my wings de-iced, and the flag became the country then, and I rose through the shortest light waves, pink agapanthus on a tall blue stem. Perpendicular. It would have been a fine path for a lizard to cross, but I saw none. Brambles and sweetbriar grew on the town side, poppies and wild grasses on the river. Too hot for birds, the ducks were out in water and mud, and frogs were out by the hundreds, it seemed, saying way, way in their deepest voices. It was beautiful there, but I'd seen beauty and its opposite so often that when warmth broke over my skin, I remembered winter. The way fresh grief undoes you the moment you're fully awake. I asked my young friend, when she turned 2, what she would serve at her birthday party, and she said, tofu and cupcakes. When she was 3, and I was very sad, she called and said, what are you doing, picking flowers? She talked in poems like she was dreaming all the time, or very old, or Virginia Woolf. More often in the first world, one wakes from, not to the nightmare. When I dreamed I lost my love, I willed myself awake because I would not survive the pain again, even dreaming. Which is responsible for that mercy, doctor? The conscious or the un? I want the poppies picked, and I want the poppies left where they grow. Like looking through the window of a moving train at someone walking up a road lined with poplars and being someone walking up a road lined with poplars. The train and the trees, a shower of petals and bees, sun on the glass and the train perpendicular to the road, things entirely themselves arriving in the deep double shadows of the grass and passers-by. I'd love to try some new poems out on you tonight from the manuscript in progress. My elderly dad has been living with us now for 4 years. He's deaf and dementing, and that's really got me thinking more overtly than ever before in my work about where we come from and why we're here at all. This poem is super new, so here goes. It's called Dedicated. The way I remember it, I caught beauty like a flu by a handshake or high five or a thank you for your service between the guys at the VA. The one who lurched toward me, touching me, saying, "You like poetry, more vision than question." The one who said, overhearing me correct my Korean conflict era dad, "Go easy, you won't have him long." Or the one who said, "You watch him like a hawk, just let him go." In the molecular biology lab, each tank full of impossibly small fish bears a sign that says, "You are responsible for your own deads." Plural, sure. The older I get, the more I am reminded of song dedications on the radio. I called Cousin Brucie to send out, "I've Got You, Babe," to my parents on their wedding anniversary. When he played them Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves, Bob and Marianne were understandably confused, but appreciative nonetheless. I myself have had three partners in my lifetime, and what I still love best about two of them is how I never had to explain that joke. There was all that time listening to radio or TV. TV turned internet. I wish I could dedicate those spent hours now to my mom, so she could come back a while. She wouldn't have to know she was dead. Like we didn't know then how much time was passing. I would play with her hair like I used to and tell her stories until she began to doze off like she used to, waking only to say, "I didn't ever know you loved me, Kath. You never wanted affection from us, Kath." Just like she used to. The wrong song, somehow the right song, playing on and on like a perfect virus. This is called The Ghost on the Handle. In case you don't speak French, sans voyageur just means no passengers. The houses here are named La Vague and Chantebrise, like places in a childhood daydream. An actual lake filled with literal swans. As a kid, I was most at home in the pages of a book, a bee sliding the banisters of the blue delphinium. Apollinaire called his books, in the soft golden bindings of the period, his blocks of butter. The sun here is like that, palpably stacked, flaking off the wavelets, filling the boats with yellow flowers, crowning the heads of the young couple arguing, body and soul. He calls her pig, whore, pig, whore, while she sobs and keeps trying to touch him. I didn't know it then, but when I was her age, we were called borough girls, a little too fashion-forward, filthy-mouthed, and ready to settle at 17. The older you get, the less surprised you think you can be. But when the bus with its sans voyageur sign roars by, I think of my child who won't get born. Ghost in a sun hat, shoulders narrow and pinked. A swan, ungainly out of water, slaps up the shore to preen with its knobbed orange beak. Mallarmé wrote that everything in the world exists in order to end up in a book, a golden book. Death, is not this the sunshine? Stray. The lamb is bleeding circles round the pasture. He slipped from his enclosure like a soul through three fences, and because he's still nursing, his calls draw alarming response from the herd. He won't come to me, though I want to help, this one they call Freezer for his not distant future. This one of ginger wool, the color and texture of my dead grandfather's hair behind his Bible. And lo, there will be joyful celebration when the shepherd delivers the stray back to his flock, the ewe's teats near to bursting at his return. How nice the little handfuls of my own mammal breasts have felt when I cup them, buoyed up above their human flesh. You think the space you occupy is large, and then you think your one life precious. Two more? Are you there? Keelson. Like a cracked cup of milk, the swan leaks white on the wet dock. It's hard to know if this is normal. I'm worried and ashamed to be. Sensitive, it was called by the family, in the hushed tones of a fatal diagnosis. My grandfather, also sensitive, was a great reader, they said, a crease in his cuffed pants, fedora on his head in all weathers. He retired early from the Cody factory, lungs clotted with sweet-smelling powder. Our rounds included the library, the church, the river, and the shoe store, each equally holy. He and the salesperson zealously attentive to the room needed for my toes to grow. As he aged, he drank less and talked more, played Simon and Garfunkel's Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme on his Victrola, cooled tea in a saucer, drew in his shaky hand what looked like boats with crosses inside. Keelson, he wrote underneath. Use this as a keelson. He dreamed it, he said, many times. God gave him the vision. How could I understand? I never saw my immigrant grandparents exchange a warm word, not a touch, not a glance, but I worried them, joined them in that worry. They sent me to drama camp once to help me come out of my shell. The teacher said I had the melancholy look of an Audrey Hepburn, only less buoyant. Teachers used to say, when you misspelled a word, look it up in the dictionary. How can you look it up in the dictionary if you can't spell it? Before the internet, nothing and no one could ask you, do you mean Swan Lake, when you looked up Swan Leak? Now, when a Swiss friend texts, let's go for perch in Morges. My heart leaps with the poetry of it, like a fish on the line, like the invisible keelsons bobbing toward the dock. Look it up. You can listen to a French speaker pronounce Morges. See Audrey Hepburn's Swiss home nearby. Memorize the French words for tea, yogurt, and cherries, which I long to buy at market each day, and which, every day, as I practice, tumble from my mouth like body parts from a dump truck. How familiar, how reassuring I envision the puzzled, pitying, mildly disgusted looks of incomprehension on the vendors' faces to be. Which is why I stopped speaking in the first place, and would sooner go hungry than ask to be understood. Last one. This is called Where I Am Going, I Dare to Live. And the title is a mashup of two lines from Lucille Clifton and Anne Sexton, in that order. I can't say grief lived there, because nothing ever did. Its purpose seemed to be to wait, and like me, to contain its waiting. When the priests called Rachel, Sarah, and Elizabeth barren, I could think only of cathedrals and railway stations, specifically dust swirling in tunnels of light, the clockwork sounds of wings and footsteps. When I studied the ancient practice ostraca, I smashed an empty flower pot, wrote my brother's name in magic marker on a shard, exiled him from the empire. To my surprise, he cried. I'd forgotten what it was I felt. I needed to see. Outside had taken me in. I loved it not for its vastness, but minutia, which I observed with the attention of one who is not herself observed and cannot bear to be. Mica in the pavement, larva in the rose, I fetishized the sea monkey, diorama, created little worlds of rules. If you see the wind holes in the cedars on one side, you miss sparrows nesting on the other. And if you leave the utility lines out of your picture, you're not being honest. Be honest. When I first saw real wallflowers spangle at the preserve in their tiny deer-proof cages, I became breathless. To be singled out, protected. We girls saved our cigarette ashes to fade our Levi's with. We crisped our hair with curling wands. We always smelled like smoke, playing as we did with fire, like Bovary or Butterfly, without beauty or the babies. One friend, a nurse now, sent video of Johnny Depp on a pediatric oncology ward. He visited as Captain Jack Sparrow, one patient in particular. Piracy and stardom had never been easier. The girl leapt into his arms. Her silent mother was more reluctant. She knew how to wait, as did those barren women of the Bible, all of whose wombs were opened by God for acts of faith, some giving birth well into their 90s. Except for one, daughter of Saul, wife of David, who, failing them both, displeased the Lord, and about whom it is written, Michal had no child to the day of her death. Thanks again.